plant. Carthage had gone bust. Its sister city, Hannibal, was losing ground to brighter, louder, cartoonier tourist spots. My beloved Mississippi River was being eaten in reverse by Asian carp flip-flopping their way up toward Lake Michigan. Amazing Amy was done. It was the end of my career, the end of hers, the end of my father, the end of my mom, the end of our marriage, the end of Amy. The ghost wheeze of the steamboat horn blew out from the river. I had sweated through the back of my shirt. I made myself stand up. I made myself buy my tour ticket. I walked the route Amy and I had taken, my wife still beside me in my mind. It was hot that day, too. "You are brilliant." In my imagination, she strolled next to me, and this time she smiled. My stomach went oily. I mind-walked my wife around the main tourist drag. A gray-haired couple paused to peer into the Huckleberry Finn house, but didn't bother to walk in. At the end of the block, a man dressed as Twain, white hair, white suit, got out of a Ford Focus, stretched, looked down the lonely street, and ducked into a pizza joint. And then there we were, at the Clapboard building that had been the courtroom of Samuel Clemens's dad. The sign out front read, J. M. Clemens, Justice of the Peace. "Let's sneak a kiss. Pretend we just got hitched." "You're making these so nice and easy, Amy. As if you actually want me to find them, to feel good about myself. Keep this up, and I'll break my record." No one was inside. I got down on my knees on the dusty floorboards and peered under the first bench. If Amy left a clue in a public place, she always taped it to the underside of things, in between the wadded gum and the dust, and she was always vindicated, because no one likes to look at the underside of things. There was nothing under the first bench, but there was a flap of paper hanging down from the bench behind. I climbed over and tugged down the Amy blue envelope, a piece of tape winging off it. "Hi, darling husband. You found it. Brilliant man. It may help that I decided to not make this year's treasure hunt an excruciating forced march through my arcane personal memories. I took a cue from your beloved Mark Twain. What ought to be done to the man who invented the celebrating of anniversaries? Mere killing would be too light. I finally get it, what you've said year after year, that this treasure hunt should be a time to celebrate us. Not a test about whether you remember everything I think or say throughout the year. You'd think that would be something a grown woman would realize on her own. But I guess that's what husbands are for. To point out what we can't see for ourselves, even if it takes 5 years. So I wanted to take a moment now, in the childhood stomping grounds of Mark Twain, and thank you for your wit. You are truly the cleverest, funniest person I know. I have a wonderful sense memory. Of all the times over the years you've leaned into my ear, I can feel your breath tickling my lobe right now as I'm writing this, and whispered something just to me, just to make me laugh. What a generous thing that is, I realize, for a husband to try to make his wife laugh. And you always picked the best moments. Do you remember when Inslee and her dancing monkey husband made us come over to admire their baby, and we did the obligatory visit to their strangely perfect, over-flowered, over-muffined house for brunch and baby meeting, and they were so self-righteous and patronizing of our childless state, and meanwhile there was their hideous boy, covered in streaks of slobber and stewed carrots and maybe some feces, naked except for a frilly bib and a pair of knitted booties. And as I sipped my orange juice, you leaned over and whispered, "That's what I'll be wearing later." And I literally did a spit take. It was one of those moments where you saved me. You made me laugh at just the right time. Just one olive, though. So let me say it again. You are witty. Now kiss me. I felt my soul deflate. Amy was using the treasure hunt to steer us back to each other, and it was too late. While she had been writing these clues, she'd had no idea of my state of mind. Why, Amy, couldn't you have done this sooner? Our timing had never been good. I opened the next clue, read it, tucked it in my pocket, then headed back home. I knew where to go, but I wasn't ready yet. I couldn't handle another compliment, another kind word from my wife, another olive branch. My feelings for her were veering too quickly from bitter to sweet. I went back to Go's, spent a few hours alone, drinking coffee and flipping around the TV, anxious and pissy, killing time till my 11 p.m. carpool to the mall. My twin got home just after 7, looking wilted from her solo bar shift. Her glance at the TV told me I should turn it off. "What did you do today?" she asked, lighting a cigarette and flopping down at our mother's old card table. "Manned the volunteer center. Then we go search the mall at 11, I said. I didn't want to tell her about Amy's clue. I felt guilty enough. Go doled out some solitaire cards, the steady slap of them on the table a rebuke. I began pacing. She ignored me. I was just watching TV to distract myself. "I know, I do." She flipped over a jack. "There's got to be something I can do," I said, stalking around her living room. "Well, you're searching the mall in a few hours," Go said, and gave no more encouragement. She flipped over 3 cards. "You sound like you think it's a waste of time."
"Oh, no. Hey, everything is worth checking out. They got Son of Sam on a parking ticket, right?"
Go was the 3rd person who'd mentioned this to me. It must be the mantra for cases going cold. I sat down across from her. "I haven't been upset enough about Amy," I said. "I know that."
"Maybe not."
She finally looked up at me.
"You're being weird."
"I think that instead of panicking, I've just focused on being pissed at her, because we are in such a bad place lately. It's like it feels wrong for me to worry too much because I don't have the right, I guess."
"You've been weird, I can't lie," Go said. "But it's a weird situation."
She stubbed out her cigarette.
"I don't care how you are with me. Just be careful with everyone else, okay? People judge. Fast."
She went back to her solitaire, but I wanted her attention. I kept talking. "I should probably check in on Dad at some point," I said. "I don't know if I'll tell him about Amy."
"No," she said. "Don't. He was even weirder about Amy than you are."
I always felt like she must remind him of an old girlfriend or something, the one who got away. After he... I made the downward swoop of a hand that signified his Alzheimer's. "He was kind of rude and awful, but..."
"Yeah, but he kind of wanted to impress her at the same time," she said. "Your basic jerky 12-year-old boy trapped in a 68-year-old asshole's body. Don't women think that all men are jerky 12-year-olds at heart? Hey, if the heart fits. 11:08 p.m. Rand was waiting for us just inside the automatic sliding doors to the hotel, his face squinting into the dark to make us out. The Hilsums were driving their pickup. Stux and I both rode in the bed. Rand came trotting up to us in khaki golf shorts and a crisp Middlebury t-shirt. He hopped in the back, planted himself on the wheel cover with surprising ease, and handled the introductions like he was the host of his own mobile talk show. "I'm really sorry about Amy, Rand," Stux said loudly, as we hurtled out of the parking lot with unnecessary speed and hit the highway. "She's such a sweet person. One time she saw me out painting a house, sweating my butt off, and she drove on to 7-Eleven, got me a giant pop, and brought it back to me, right up on the ladder." This was a lie. Amy cared so little for Stux or his refreshment that she wouldn't have bothered to piss in a cup for him.
"That sounds like her," Rand said,
and I was flush with unwelcome, ungentlemanly annoyance. Maybe it was the journalist in me, but facts were facts, and people didn't get to turn Amy into everyone's beloved best friend just because it was emotionally expedient.
"Middlebury, huh?"
Stux continued, pointing at Rand's t-shirt.
"Got a hell of a rugby team."
"That's right, we do," Rand said, the big smile again,
and he and Stux began an improbable discussion of liberal arts rugby over the noise of the car, the air, the night, all the way to the mall. Joe Hilsum parked his truck outside the giant cornerstone Mervyn's. We all hopped out, stretched our legs, shook ourselves awake. The night was muggy and moon-slivered. I noticed Stux was wearing, maybe ironically, possibly not, a t-shirt that read, "Save Gas, Fart in a Jar."
"So this place, what we're doing, it's freaking dangerous. I don't want to lie," Mikey Hilsum began.
He had beefed up over the years, as had his brother. They weren't just barrel-chested, but barrel-everythinged. Standing side by side, they were about 500 pounds of dude.
"We came here once, me and Mikey, just for, I don't know, to see it, I guess. See what it had become. And we almost got our asses handed to us," said Joe. "So tonight, we take no chances."
He reached into the cab for a long canvas bag and unzipped it to reveal half a dozen baseball bats. He began handing them out solemnly. When he got to Rand, he hesitated.
You want one?"
"Hell yes, I do," Rand said.
And they all nodded and smiled approval, the energy in the circle a friendly backslap, a "good for you, old man."
"Come on,"
Mikey said, and led us along the exterior.
"There's a door with a lock smashed off down here near the Spencers."
Just then, we passed the dark windows of Shooby Dooby, where my mom had worked for more than half my life. I still remember the thrill of her going to apply for a job at that most wondrous of places, the mall. Leaving one Saturday morning for the job fair in her bright peach pantsuit, a 40-year-old woman looking for work for the first time, and her coming home with a flushed grin. We couldn't imagine how busy the mall was. So many different kinds of stores. And who knew which one she might work in? She applied to 9. Clothing stores and stereo stores and even a designer popcorn store. When she announced a week later that she was officially a shoe sales lady, her kids were underwhelmed.
"You'll have to touch all sorts of stinky feet,"
Go complained. I'll get to meet all sorts of interesting people, our mom corrected. I peered into the gloomy window. The place was entirely vacant, except for a shoe sizer lined pointlessly against the wall. My mom used to work here, I told Rand, forcing him to linger with me.
What kind of place was it?
It was a nice place. They were good to her.
I mean, what did they do here?
Oh, shoes. They did shoes.
That's right. Shoes. I like that. Something people actually need. And at the end of the day, you know what you've done. You've sold 5 people shoes. Not like writing, huh? Done, come on!
Stux was leaning against the open door ahead. The others had gone inside. I'd expected the mall smell as we entered, that temperature-controlled hollowness. Instead, I smelled old grass and dirt, the scent of the outdoors inside, where it had no place being. The building was heavy hot, almost fuzzy, like the inside of a mattress. 3 of us had giant camping flashlights, the glow illuminating jarring images. It was suburbia post-comet, post-zombie, post-humanity. A set of muddy shopping cart tracks looped crazily along the white flooring. A raccoon chewed on a dog treat in the entry to a women's bathroom, his eyes flashing like dimes. The whole mall was quiet. Mikey's voice echoed. Our footsteps echoed. Stux's drunken giggle echoed. We would not be a surprise attack, if attack was what we had in mind. When we reached the central promenade of the mall, the whole area ballooned, 4 stories high, escalators and elevators crisscrossing in the black. We all gathered near a dried-up fountain and waited for someone to take the lead.
So, guys, Rand said doubtfully, what's the plan here? You all know this place, and I don't. We need to figure out how to systematically...
We heard a loud metal rattle right behind us. A security gate going up.
Hey, there's one!
Stux yelled. He trained his flashlight on a man in a billowing rain slicker, shooting out from the entry of a Claire's, running full speed away from us.
Stop him!
Joe yelled, and began running after him, thick tennis shoes slapping against the ceramic tile, Mikey right behind him, flashlight trained on the stranger, the 2 brothers calling gruffly,
Hold up there! Hey, guy, we just have a question!
The man didn't even give a backward glance.
I said hold on, motherfucker!
The runner remained silent amid the yelling, but he picked up speed and shot down the mall corridor, in and out of the flashlight's glow, his slicker flapping behind him like a cape. Then the guy turned acrobatic, leaping over a trash can, shimmying off the edge of a fountain, and finally slipping under a metal security gate to the gap and disappearing.
Fucker!
The Hilsums had turned heart attack red in the face, the neck, the fingers. They took turns grunting at the gate, straining to lift it. I reached down with them, but there was no budging it over half a foot. I lay down on the floor and tried threading myself under the gate, toes, calves, then stuck at my waist.
Nope, no go,
I grunted.
Fuck!
I pulled up and shone my flashlight into the store. The showroom was empty except for a pile of clothing racks someone had dragged to the center, as if to start a bonfire. All the stores connect in the back to passageways for trash, plumbing, I said. He's probably at the other end of the mall by now.
Well, then, let's go to the other end of the mall, Rand said. Come out, you fuckers!
Joe yelled. His head tilted back, eyes scrunched. His voice echoed through the building. We began walking ragtag, trailing our bats alongside us, except for the Hilsums, who used theirs to bang against security gates and doors, like they were on military patrol in a particularly nasty war zone.
Better you come to us than we come to you,
Mikey called.
Oh, hello.
In the entryway to a pet shop, a man and woman huddled on a few army blankets, their hair wet with sweat. Mikey loomed over them, breathing heavily, wiping his brow. It was the scene in the war movie when the frustrated soldiers come across innocent villagers and bad things happen.
The fuck you want?
The man on the floor asked. He was emaciated, his face so thin and drawn it looked like it was melting. His hair was tangled to his shoulders, his eyes mournful and upturned. A despoiled Jesus. The woman was in better shape, with clean, plump arms and legs, her lank hair oily, but brushed.
You a blue book boy?
Stux asked.
Ain't no boy anyhow,
the man muttered, folding his arms.
Have some fucking respect,
the woman snapped. Then she looked like she might cry. She turned away from us, pretending to look at something in the distance.
I'm sick of no one having no respect.
We asked you a question, buddy,
Mikey said, moving closer to the guy, kicking the sole of his foot.
I ain't blue book, the man said. Just down on my luck.
Bullshit.
Lots of different people here, not just blue books. But if that's who you're looking for...
go on then, and find them,
the woman said, her mouth turning down.
Go bother them!
They deal down in the hole, the man said.
When we looked blank, he pointed.
The Mervins, far end, past where the carousel used to be.
And fuck you very much,
the woman muttered. A crop circle stain marked where the carousel once was. Amy and I had taken a ride just before the mall shut down. Two grown-ups, side by side on levitating bunny rabbits, because my wife wanted to see the mall where I spent so much of my childhood, wanted to hear my stories. It wasn't all bad with us. The barrier gate to the Mervins had been busted through, so the store was open as wide and welcoming as the morning of a President's Day sale. Inside, the place was cleared out except for the islands that once held cash registers and now held about a dozen people in various states of drug highs, under signs that read jewelry and beauty and bedding. They were illuminated by gas camping lamps that flickered like tiki torches. A few guys barely opened an eye as we passed. Others were out cold. In a far corner, two kids not long out of their teens were manically reciting the Gettysburg Address.
Now we are engaged in a great civil war.
One man sprawled out on the rug in immaculate jean shorts and white tennis shoes, like he was on the way to his kid's t-ball game. Rand stared at him as if he might know the guy. Carthage had a bigger drug epidemic than I ever knew. The cops had been here just yesterday, and already the druggies had resettled, like determined flies. As we made our way through the piles of humans, an obese woman shushed up to us on an electric scooter. Her face was pimply and wet with sweat, her teeth cat-like.
You buying or leaving? Because this ain't a show and tell, she said.
Stux shone a flashlight on her face.
Get that fucking thing off me.
He did. I'm looking for my wife, I began. Amy Dunn. She's been missing since Thursday.
She'll show up. She'll wake up, drag herself home.
We're not worried about drugs, I said. We're more concerned about some of the men here. We've heard rumors.
It's okay, Melanie, a voice called.
At the edge of the junior section, a rangy man leaned against a naked mannequin torso, watching us, a sideways grin on his face. Melanie shrugged, bored, annoyed, and motored away. The man kept his eyes on us, but called toward the back of the junior section, where four sets of feet poked out from the dressing rooms, men camped out in their individual cubicles.
Hey, Lonnie! Hey, all! The assholes are back! 5 of them, the man said.
He kicked an empty beer can toward us. Behind him, 3 sets of feet began moving, men pulling themselves up. One set remained still, their owner asleep, or passed out.
Yeah, fuckos, we're back, Mikey Hilsum said.
He held his bat like a pool cue and punched the mannequin torso between the breasts. She tottered toward the ground, the blue book guy removing his arm gracefully as she fell, as if it were all part of a rehearsed act.
We want some information on a missing girl.
The 3 men from the dressing rooms joined their friends. They all wore Greek party t-shirts. Pi Phi Tie-Dye and Fiji Island. Local Goodwills got inundated with these come summer, university graduates shedding their old souvenirs. The men were all wiry strong, muscular arms rivered with popping blue veins. Behind them, a guy with a long, drooping mustache and hair in a ponytail, Lonnie, came out of the largest corner dressing room, dragging a long length of pipe, wearing a Gamma Phi t-shirt. We were looking at mall security.
What's up? Lonnie called.
We cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground.
The kids were reciting in a pitch that was close to screaming.
We're looking for Amy Dunn. You've probably seen her on the news, missing since Thursday, Joe Hilsum said. Nice, pretty, sweet lady. Stolen from her own home.
I heard about it.
So?
Said Lonnie. She's my wife, I said.
We know what you guys have been getting into out here, Joe continued,
addressing only Lonnie, who was tossing his ponytail behind him, squaring his jaw. Faded green tattoos covered his fingers.
We know about the gang rape.
I glanced at Rand to see if he was all right. He was staring at the naked mannequin on the floor.
Gang rape,
Lonnie said, jerking his head back.
The fuck you talking about a gang rape?
You guys, Joe said. You blue book boys.
Blue book boys, like we're some kind of crew.
Lonnie sniffed.
We're not animals, asshole. We don't steal women. People want to feel okay for not helping us. See, they don't deserve it. They're a bunch of rapists.
Well, bullshit.
I'd get the fuck out of this town if the plant would give me my back pay. But I got nothing. None of us got nothing. So here we are.
We'll give you money. Good money, if you can tell us anything about Amy's disappearance, I said. You guys know a lot of people. Maybe you heard something. I pulled out her photo. The Hilsums and Stux looked surprised, and I realized, of course, this was only a macho diversion for them. I pushed the photo in Lonnie's face, expecting him to barely glance. Instead, he leaned in closer.
"Oh, shit," he said. "Her? You recognize her?"
He actually looked stricken.
"She wanted to buy a gun."
Amy Elliott Dunn, October 16, 2010. Diary entry. Happy anniversary to me. 1 full month as a Missouri resident, and I am on my way to becoming a good Midwesterner. Yep, I have gone cold turkey off all things East Coast, and I have earned my 30-day chip. Here, it would be a potato chip. I am taking notes. I am honoring traditions. I am the Margaret Mead of the goddamn Mississippi. Let's see, what's new? Nick and I are currently embroiled in what I have taken to calling, to myself, the cuckoo clock conundrum. My parents' cherished heirloom looks ridiculous in the new house. But then all our New York stuff does. Our dignified elephant of a Chesterfield, with its matching baby ottoman, sits in the living room looking stunned, as if it got sleep-darted in its natural environment and woke up in this strange new captivity, surrounded by faux posh carpet and synthetic wood and unveined walls. I do miss our old place, all the bumps and ridges and hairline fractures left by the decades. Pause for attitude adjustment. But new is nice, too. Just different. The clock would disagree. The cuckoo is also having a tough time adjusting to its new space. The little bird lurches out drunkenly at 10 minutes after the hour, 17 minutes before, 41 past. It emits a dying wail, cuckoo, that every time brings Bleeker trotting in from some hideaway, eyes wild, all business, his tail a bottle brush as he tilts his head toward the feathers and mules.
"Wow, your parents must really hate me,"
Nick says whenever we're both in earshot of the noise, though he's smart enough not to recommend ridding ourselves of the thing just yet. I actually want to trash it, too. I am the one, the jobless, at home all day, just waiting for its squawk, a tense moviegoer steeling myself for the next outburst from the crazy patron behind me, both relieved, there it is, and angry, there it is, each time it comes. Much to do was made over the clock at the housewarming. Oh, look at that, an antique clock, which Mama Maureen Dunn insisted on. Actually, not insisted on. Mama Mo does not insist. She simply makes things a reality by assuming they are such. From the first morning after the move, when she appeared on our doorstep with a welcome home egg scramble and a family pack of toilet paper, which didn't speak well for the egg scramble, she'd spoken of the housewarming as if it were a fact.
"So when do you want to do your housewarming? Have you thought about who I should invite to the housewarming? Do you want a housewarming or something fun, like a stock-the-bar party? But a traditional housewarming is always nice."
And then suddenly there was a date, and the date was today, and Dunn family and friends were shaking off the October drizzle from umbrellas and carefully, conscientiously, wiping their feet on the floor mat Maureen had brought for us this morning. The rug says, "All our friends who enter here." It is from Costco. I have learned about bulk shopping in my 4 weeks as a Mississippi River resident. Republicans go to Sam's Club, Democrats go to Costco. But everyone buys bulk because, unlike Manhattanites, they all have space to store 24 jars of sweet pickles. And, unlike Manhattanites, they all have uses for 24 jars of sweet pickles. No gathering is complete without a Lazy Susan full of pickles and Spanish olives right from the jar.
and a salt lick.
I set the scene. It is one of those big-smelling days when people bring the outdoors in with them, the scent of rain on their sleeves, in their hair. The older women, Maureen's friends, present varying food items in plastic, dishwasher-safe containers they will later ask to be returned. And ask, and ask. I know now that I am supposed to wash out the containers and drop each of them back by their proper homes, a Ziploc carpool, but when I first came here, I was unaware of the protocol. I dutifully recycled all the plastic containers, and so I had to go buy all new ones. Maureen's best friend, Vicky, immediately noticed her container was brand new, store-bought, an imposter, and when I explained my confusion, she widened her eyes in amazement. So that's how they do it in New York. But the housewarming. The older women are Maureen's friends from long-ago PTA meetings, from book clubs, from the shooby-dooby at the mall, where she spent 40 hours a week slipping sensible block heels onto women of a certain age. She can size a foot on sight. Women's eight, narrow. It's her go-to party trick. All Mo's friends love Nick, and they all have stories about sweet things Nick has done for them over the years. The younger women, the women representing the pool of possible Amy friends, all sport the same bleached blonde wedge haircut, the same slip-on mules. They are the daughters of Maureen's friends, and they all love Nick, and they all have stories about sweet things Nick has done for them over the years. Most of them are out of work from the mall closings, or their husbands are out of work from the mall closings, so they all offer me recipes for cheap and easy eats that usually involve a casserole made from canned soup, butter, and a snack chip. The men are nice and quiet and hunker in circles, talking about sports and smiling benevolently toward me. Everyone is nice. They are literally as nice as they can be. Maureen, the tri-state's hardiest cancer patient, introduces me to all her friends the same way you'd show off a slightly dangerous new pet. This is Nick's wife, Amy, who was born and raised in New York City. And her friends, plump and welcoming, immediately suffer some strange Tourettesian episode. They repeat the words, New York City, with clasped hands and say something that defies response. That must have been neat. Or, in reedy voices, they sing, New York, New York, rocking side to side with tiny jazz hands. Maureen's friend from the shoe store, Barb, drawls, New York City? Get a rope! And when I squint at her in confusion, she says, Oh, it's from that old salsa commercial. And when I still fail to connect, she blushes, puts a hand on my arm, and says, I wouldn't really hang you. Ultimately, everyone trails off into giggles and confesses they've never been to New York, or that they've been once and didn't care for it much. Then I say something like, you'd like it, or it's definitely not for everyone, or because I've run out of things to say. Be friendly, Amy. Nick spits into my ear when we're refilling drinks in the kitchen. Midwesterners love 2 liters of soda, always 2 liters, and you pour them into big red plastic solo cups. Always. I am, I whine. It really hurts my feelings, because if you asked anyone in that room whether I'd been friendly, I know they'd say yes. Sometimes I feel like Nick has decided on a version of me that doesn't exist. Since we've moved here, I've done girls' nights out and charity walks. I've cooked casseroles for his dad and helped sell tickets for raffles. I tapped the last of my money to give to Nick and Go so they could buy the bar they've always wanted,
and I even put the check inside a card shaped like a mug of beer. Cheers to you. And Nick just gave a flat, begrudging thanks. I don't know what to do. I'm trying. We deliver the soda pops, me smiling and laughing even harder, a vision of grace and good cheer, asking everyone if I can get them anything else, complimenting women on ambrosia salads and crab dips and pickle slices wrapped in cream cheese wrapped in salami. Nick's dad arrives with Go. They stand silently on the doorstep, Midwest Gothic. Bill Dunn, wiry and still handsome, a tiny band-aid on his forehead. Go, grim-faced, her hair in barrettes, her eyes averted from her father.
Nick?
Bill Dunn says, shaking his hand, and he steps inside, frowning at me. Go follows, grabs Nick, and pulls him back behind the door, whispering,
I have no idea where he is right now, headwise. Like, if he's having a bad day, or if he's just being a jackass. No idea.
Okay, okay. Don't worry, I'll keep an eye on him.
Go shrugs pissily.
I'm serious, Go. Grab a beer and take a break. You are relieved of dad duty for the next hour.
I think, if that had been me, he'd complain that I was being too sensitive. The older women keep swirling around me, telling me how Maureen has always said what a wonderful couple Nick and I are, and she is right. We are clearly made for each other. I prefer these well-meant clichés to the talk we heard before we got married. Marriage is compromise and hard work, and then more hard work, and communication, and compromise, and then work. Abandon all hope, ye who enter. The engagement party back in New York was the worst for this. All the guests hot with wine and resentment, as if every set of spouses had gotten into an argument on the way to the club. Or they remembered some argument. Like Binks. Binks Moriarty, my mom's best friend's 88-year-old mother, stopped me at the bar, bellowed,
Amy, I must talk to you.
In an emergency room voice. She twisted her precious rings on over-knuckled fingers, twist, turn, creak, and fondled my arm. That old person grope, cold fingers coveting your nice, soft, warm new skin. And then Binks told me how her late husband of 63 years had trouble
keeping it in his pants.
Binks said this with one of those, I'm almost dead, I can say this kind of stuff, grins, and cataract-clouded eyes.
He just couldn't keep it in his pants,
the old lady said urgently, her hand chilling my arm in a death grip.
But he loved me more than any of them. I know it, and you know it.
The moral to the story being, Mr. Binks was a cheating dickweasel, but, you know, marriage is compromise. I retreated quickly and began circulating through the crowd, smiling at a series of wrinkled faces, that baggy, exhausted, disappointed look that people get in middle age, and all the faces were like that. Most of them were also drunk, dancing steps from their youth, swaying to country club funk, and that seemed even worse. I was making my way to the French windows for some air, and a hand squeezed my arm. Nick's mom, Mama Maureen, with her big black laser eyes, her eager pug-dog face. Thrusting a wad of goat cheese and crackers into her mouth, Maureen managed to say,
"It's not easy. Pairing yourself off with someone forever. It's an admirable thing, and I'm glad you're both doing it, but boy, oh, girl, oh, there will be days you wish you'd never done it. And those will be the good times, when it's only days of regret, and not months."
I must have looked shocked,
I was definitely shocked, because she said quickly, "But then you have good times, too. I know you will. You, too. A lot of good times. So, just forgive me, sweetheart, what I said before. I'm just being a silly old divorced lady. Oh, mother of pearl, I think I had too much wine." And she fluttered a goodbye at me and scampered away through all the other disappointed couples.
"You're not supposed to be here,"
Bill Dunn was suddenly saying, and he was saying it to me.
"Why are you here? You're not allowed here."
"I'm Amy," I say, touching his arm as if that might wake him. Bill has always liked me. Even if he could think of nothing to say to me, I could tell he liked me, the way he watched me like I was a rare bird. Now he is scowling, thrusting his chest toward me, a caricature of a young sailor ready to brawl. A few feet away, Go sets down her food and gets ready to move toward us, quietly, like she is trying to catch a fly.
"Why are you in our house?"
Bill Dunn says, his mouth grimacing.
"You've got some nerve, lady."
"Nick," Go calls behind her, not loudly, but urgently.
"Got it," Nick says, appearing. "Hey, Dad, this is my wife, Amy. Remember, Amy? We moved back home so we could see you more. This is our new house."
Nick glares at me. I was the one who insisted we invite his dad.
"All I'm saying, Nick,"
Bill Dunn says, pointing now, jabbing an index finger toward my face, the party going hushed, several men moving slowly, cautiously in from the other room, their hands twitching, ready to move.
"It's she doesn't belong here. Little bitch thinks she can do whatever she wants."
Mama Mo swoops in then, her arm around her ex-husband, always, always rising to the occasion.
"Of course she belongs here, Bill. It's her house. She's your son's wife, remember?"
"I want her out of here. Do you understand me, Maureen?"
He shrugs her off and starts moving toward me again.
"Dumb bitch. Dumb bitch."
It's unclear if he means me or Maureen, but then he looks at me and tightens his lips.
"She doesn't belong here."
"I'll go," I say, and turn away, walk straight out the door into the rain. From the mouths of Alzheimer's patients, I think, trying to make light. I walk a loop around the neighborhood, waiting for Nick to appear, to guide me back to our house. The rain spackles me gently, dampening me. I really believe Nick will come after me. I turn toward the house and see only a closed door.
Nick Dunn. 4 days gone. Rand and I sat in the vacant Find Amy Dunn headquarters at 5 a.m, drinking coffee while we waited for the cops to check out Lonnie. Amy stared at us from her poster perch on the wall. Her photo looked distressed.
"I just don't understand why she wouldn't say something to you if she was afraid," Rand said. "Why wouldn't she tell you?"
Amy had come to the mall to buy a gun on Valentine's Day, of all days. That's what our friend Lonnie had said. She was a little abashed, a little nervous. "Maybe I'm being silly, but I just really think I need a gun." Mostly, though, she was scared. Someone was unnerving her, she told Lonnie. She gave no more details, but when he asked her what kind of gun she wanted, she said, "One that stops someone fast." He told her to come back in a few days, and she did. He hadn't been able to get her one.
"It's not really my bag, man."
But now he wished he had. He remembered her well. Over the months, he'd wondered how she was now and then, this sweet blonde with a fearful face, trying to get a gun on Valentine's Day.
Who would she be afraid of? Rand asked.
Tell me about Desi again, Rand, I said. Did you ever meet him?
He came to the house a few times.
Rand frowned, remembering.
He was a nice-looking kid, very solicitous of Amy, treated her like a princess. But I just never liked him. Even when things were good with them, young love, Amy's first love, even then I disliked him. He was very rude to me, inexplicably so. Very possessive of Amy, arms around her at all times. I found it strange, very strange, that he wouldn't try to be nice to us. Most young men want to get in good with the parents.
I wanted to.
And you did.
He smiled.
You were just the right amount of nervous. It was very sweet. Desi wasn't anything but nasty.
Desi's less than an hour out of town.
True. And Hillary Handy?
Rand said, rubbing his eyes.
I don't want to be sexist here. She was scarier than Desi. Because that Lonnie guy at the mall, he didn't say Amy was afraid of a man.
No, he just said she was afraid, I said. There is that Noelle Hawthorne girl, the one who lives near us. She told the police she was best friends with Amy when I know she wasn't. They weren't even friends. Her husband says she's been in hysterics, that she was looking at pictures of Amy, crying. At the time, I thought they were internet photos, but what if they were actual photos she had of Amy? What if she was stalking Amy?
She tried to talk with me when I was a little busy yesterday, Rand said. She quoted some Amazing Amy stuff at me. Amazing Amy and the Best Friend War, actually. Best friends are the people who know us best.
Sounds like Hillary, I said. All grown up. We met Boney and Gilpin just after 7 a.m. at an IHOP out along the highway for a showdown. It was ridiculous that we were doing their job for them. It was insane that we were the ones discovering leads. It was time to call in the FBI if the local cops couldn't handle it. A plump, amber-eyed waitress took our orders, poured us coffee, and, clearly recognizing me, lingered within eavesdropping distance until Gilpin scattered her away. She was like a determined housefly, though. Between drink refills and dispensing of utensils and the magically quick arrival of our food, our entire harangue came in limp bursts. This is unacceptable. No more coffee, thanks. It's unbelievable that... Sure, rye is fine. Before we were done, Boney interrupted. I understand, guys. It's natural to want to feel involved. But what you did was dangerous. You have got to let us handle this kind of thing. That's just it, though. You aren't handling it, I said. You'd never have gotten this information about the gun if we didn't go out there last night. What did Lonnie say when you talked to him?
Same thing you said he said, Gilpin said. Amy wanted to buy a gun. She was scared.
You don't seem that impressed by this information, I snapped. Do you think he was lying? We don't think he was lying, Boney said. There's no reason for the guy to invite police attention to himself. He seemed very struck by your wife. Very, I don't know, rattled that this had happened to her. He remembered specific details. Nick, he said she was wearing a green scarf that day. You know, not a winter scarf, but a fashion statement scarf. She made fluttering moves with her fingers to show she thought fashion to be childish, unworthy of her attention. Emerald green. Ring a bell? I nodded.
She has one she wears with blue jeans a lot. And a pin on her jacket. A gold cursive A? Yes. Boney shrugged. Well, that settles it. You don't think he might have been so struck by her that he kidnapped her? I asked. He has an alibi. Rock solid, Boney said, giving me a pointed look. To tell the truth, we've begun to look for a different kind of motive. Something more personal, Gilpin added. He looked dubiously at his pancakes, topped with strawberries and puffs of whipped cream. He began scraping them to the side of his plate. More personal, I said. So does that mean you're finally going to talk to Desi Collings or Hillary Handy? Or do I need to? I had, in fact, promised Mary Beth I'd go today. Sure we will, Boney said. She had the placating tone of a girl promising her pesky mom to eat better. We doubt it's a lead, but we'll talk to them. Well, great. Thanks for doing your job. Kind of, I said. And what about Noelle Hawthorne? If you want someone close to home, she's right in our complex, and she seems a little obsessed with Amy. I know, she's called us, and she's on our list, Gilpin nodded. Today. Good. What else are you doing? Nick, we'd actually like you to make some time for us. Let us pick your brain a bit more, Boney said. Spouses often know more than they realize. We'd like you to think a bit more about the argument. That barn burner your neighbor Mrs. Taverer overheard you and Amy having the night before she went missing. Rand's head jerked toward me. Jan Taverer, the Christian casserole lady, who wouldn't meet my eye anymore. I mean, could it have been because... I know this is hard to hear, Mr. Elliot. Because Amy was under the influence of something? Boney asked. Innocent eyes. I mean, maybe she has had contact with less savory elements in town. There are plenty of other drug dealers. Maybe she got in over her head, and that's why she wanted a gun. There's got to be a reason she wants a gun for protection and doesn't tell her husband. And Nick, we'd like you to think harder about where you were between that time, the time of the argument about 11 p.m., the last anyone heard Amy's voice, besides me, besides you, and noon, when you arrived at your bar. If you were out and about in this town, driving to the beach, hanging around the dock area, someone must have seen you, even if it was someone just, you know, walking his dog. If you can help us, I think that would be really...
helpful, Gilpin finished. He speared a strawberry.
They both watched me attentively, congenially.
It'd be super helpful, Nick, Gilpin repeated more pleasantly.
First time I'd heard about the argument, that they knew about it, and they chose to tell me in front of Rand, and they chose to pretend it wasn't a gotcha.
Sure thing, I said.
You mind telling us what it was about? Boney asked. The argument?
What did Mrs. Taverer tell you it was about?
I hate to take her word when I got you right here.
She poured some cream into her coffee.
It was such a nothing argument, I began. That's why I never mentioned it. Just both of us scrapping at each other, the way couples do sometimes.
Rand looked at me as if he had no clue what I was talking about.
Scrapping? What is this scrapping of which you speak?
It was just about dinner, I lied. About what we'd do for dinner for our anniversary. You know, Amy is a traditionalist about these things. The lobster, Rand interrupted. He turned to the cops. Amy cooks lobster every year for Nick. Right, but there's nowhere to get lobster in this town, not alive, from the tank, so she was frustrated.